Hi, you're in Pinky's Corner in WND from the Atlantic City Hilton.
Oh, hi, Pinky.
Yes, sir. How are you?
We're in the midst of rejuvenating Atlantic City. The casinos this past year generated $5 billion. This industry has created over 40,000 jobs. Come and see for yourself.
Atlantic City was a great place to work and socialize. Barbara worked at several of the casinos as a cocktail waitress.
My name is Valerie Ann Stay, and my sister was Barbara Brider. She was very sensitive. Every time I talked to her, she'd end the conversation with, "I love you, I love you." On October 17th, Barbara had gone out, was taking a bus to Atlantic City. That was the last that anyone heard from her. She never answered her phone again.
Most likely, Barbara was picked up in Atlantic City, taken somewhere, an unknown location where she was murdered. The killer brought her back here on this access road and dumped her body in this drainage ditch.
I went numb. I just went numb and in shock. I'd have to tell her daughter.
She was very loving and caring. This is a painting I painted for my mom. It says, "God bless my mom."
In 1997, Barbara had a daughter named Dominique.
She was a good woman. She didn't deserve what happened to her at all.
The gruesome find has triggered a massive investigation.
When police officers searched the area, not only did they find Barbara Brider's body, but they found another three bodies in the same location. Kimberly Raffo, Tracy Ann Roberts, Molly Jean Diltz.
The bodies of four women are found behind a strip of motels near Atlantic City tonight.
In almost the 28 years that I served in that police department, nothing like that has ever happened.
We knew right off the bat that this was a serial killer. He wants to have power and control over the area, over Atlantic City. I'm godlike. I have the power over life and death. I'm John Kelly. I'm a criminal profiler. He knows he's crossed that point of no return, and yes, he will kill again.
Beyond the Boardwalk, tonight's 48 Hours Mystery.
A few short miles from the glittering casinos of Atlantic City sits this strip of low-rent motels. Behind them, a lonely path runs along a drainage ditch.
Hello, police department, help you?
Yes, me and my friend were taking a walk down the path. I look down the water, and there's a dead woman down there.
On November 20th, 2006, that 911 call led police in the Atlantic City suburb of Egg Harbor Township to the grisly discovery. Spaced out along that path were four dead women.
Captain, what's your theory of what happened here?
Most likely there was one killer involved with all four victims.
At the time, John DeAngelis was a captain on the force. When police examined the first body, they immediately noticed something strange.
They had discovered that the victim did not have any shoes on and was barefoot.
In fact, it turned out that all four victims were methodically positioned in the same bizarre manner.
All facing east, all with no shoes on, no purse, no cell phone, no personal belongings. It appears that these women were killed just for the sake of being killed.
A horrible discovery. The bodies of four women floating in a ditch.
There's a madman out here.
Fear of a serial killer on the loose rocked Atlantic City and the entire Northeast. Police had a high-profile case on their hands with few clues,
And as they began to identify the victims, it took on a new and more troubling dimension. All four murdered women had friends and family who loved and supported them. So why and how did they end up in a place like this?
I just felt like something horrible happened.
Barbara's sisters, Francine and Valerie, were not surprised when they learned she was one of the victims. Barbara had been missing for weeks.
And I knew right away, we're going to be looking for a body.
Fran and Val prefer to remember their sister in happier days.
There's the three of us.
Growing up in the Philadelphia suburbs, spending summers with Barbara on the Jersey Shore.
Barbara was raised in a very stable, loving home.
But Barbara had trouble coping with the sudden death of her father.
Complete devastation. She was depressed.
After a tough year at Penn State University, Barbara left school and returned to the South Jersey Shore. She held several steady jobs and went on to achieve a lifelong goal, motherhood.
And the way she was with her daughter, she was very affectionate and loving.
I miss her a lot. It's too hard to just let her go.
Barbara was 42 years old. Dominique is only 9.
The post-mortem examinations, which are critical, started this morning.
Solving Barbara's murder and the other three was the job of Atlantic City prosecutor Jeffrey Blitz. He formed a special task force to crack the case.
We've already lifted the print from body number one.
Barbara was not the first body Blitz identified. That was 35-year-old Kim Raffo.
I know her kids, her family, her sister, her mother, gosh, everybody, we're all gonna miss her a lot.
Kim's cousin, Juliet, remembers the two of them growing up on the streets of Brooklyn.
Always smiling, you know, always happy.
As Kim grew into a young adult, she seemed to be headed in the right direction.
She really had it together, and I was so proud of her.
I don't know, I just felt perfectly at home with her. I could say anything with her.
Hugh Auslander fell in love with Kim and married her in 1989. The young couple moved to Florida and had two children.
She was a perfect stay-at-home mom.
Hugh worked a good construction job while Kim devoted herself to the kids.
Everything was about as good as it gets.
But then things began to fall apart. Kim fell in love with another man, a chef she'd met at a cooking class. By 2003, the marriage was over. Kim eventually moved to Atlantic City with her lover. 3 years after they arrived in town, Kim Raffo was dead.
She died as a result of ligature strangulation.
Kim was strangled to death. The next victim identified died similarly. She was 23-year-old Tracy Ann Roberts.
Tracy came from a small town in Delaware, went to a good school, went on to be trained as a medical assistant.
Tracy had only moved to Atlantic City within the past year.
Everybody that knew her and said that she was a really nice, pretty young person that had her whole future ahead of her.
Two of the female victims have been confirmed murdered, and the final two bodies are too badly decomposed to determine a cause of death.
6 days after the bodies were found, Barbara was identified through dental records.
Now, new developments in the investigation of the bodies found.
The fourth and final victim was the youngest.
Identifying the fourth victim was difficult because she had been in that ditch for more than a month. To determine who she was, Blitz's office released images of her tattoos.
It was a tattoo of a bulldog, an English bulldog. All the family members recognized it immediately.
The woman's name was Molly Diltz, just 20 years old.
It floors you. There's nothing that can get you ready for this, nothing.
Her uncle Steve and Sam Taylor struggled to cope with the loss.
She had a lot of good to spread to the world, and it's just a shame that she won't be able to do that now.
Molly was from Black Lick, Pennsylvania, a mining town where money is tight and family is tighter. She had endured her fair share of hardship, losing both her mother and her brother when she was just a teen.
For everything that that poor girl had gone through, she came out pretty damn well.
Molly had had some minor scrapes with the law, but after she gave birth to her son, Jeremiah, she seemed to be getting her act together.
Wanted to take care of her baby and get a job.
But in the summer of 2006, Molly left Jeremiah in the care of her family and left Black Lick behind her.
She was just going out there to pursue a better life.
In the first week of October, Molly contacted her family, calling Collect from a New Jersey number.
And they traced it down to a payphone in downtown Atlantic City.
They would never hear her voice again. Four lives with little apparent connection. But investigators quickly discovered that the four victims did have something in common. They all had a dark side. The hunt for the killer would lead deep into that darkness.
Atlantic City was conceived from the very beginning as a place for fantasy. People came here to play out their fantasy.
For decades, Atlantic City has been an iconic American vacation land, a powerful magnet for people trying to escape their troubles. Kim, Barbara, Tracy, and Molly were no exception.
These are four people who came to Atlantic City to remake themselves.
Historian Bryant Simon.
Something that fantasy cities promise all the time.
Summer 1940, it would be wall-to-wall people. You could not walk a full stride down the boardwalk.
But in the 1970s, the city's economy collapsed. So New Jersey made the ultimate gamble.
Come on, six, baby.
Legalizing casinos. In the 30 years since, the impact has been profound. Kim Raffo took a chance on Atlantic City, moving here in 2003 with her new man, Kenny Bilecki.
Things were really good when we got up here. We were making money and we were trying to build a life.
Kim and Kenny, a trained chef, held steady jobs at a restaurant in the Taj Mahal Casino. Kim became close friends with a local bartender, John Pesh.
When I first met her, she had an apartment and a job, and she was just a regular person like everybody else.
But it didn't take long for Kim to learn that life in Atlantic City changes the second you walk out the casino doors.
The wealth generated by the casinos has created a boom outside the city, leaving the core of the city with the least fortunate.
The result? An almost surreal juxtaposition. Magnificent, opulent casinos surrounded by dead zones of poverty and crime.
It's definitely a dichotomy. It's a small town with big city problems.
Jim Hutchins, a recently retired Atlantic City police captain, took us out on the streets.
What is the game? What goes on out here?
A little bit of everything out here. There's narcotic activity. There's prostitution activity.
We cruised Pacific Avenue, known locally as the Track, just a block inland from the boardwalk.
What's that on the left? The working girls?
They were working girls. I don't think they're selling Girl Scout cookies over there.
What's up, baby? How much?
20.
It was in this double world of glitz and grime that Kim Raffo struggled to make ends meet.
Every time we would leave our building, you know, we would be approached by drug dealers and to buy drugs. And
Kenny says that eventually they both got caught up in the scene.
We started drinking and fell into the crack scene, you know, and started smoking it.
Kim had left her kids with Hugh. John Pesch says that searing regret drove her drug abuse.
She was in pain, mentally, emotionally. It was important to her to take care of her kids, and when she didn't, it really upset her.
Crack, it makes you escape reality for moments.
Kim had used drugs socially before, but now she was a full-blown addict.
How crazy did it get?
Absolutely crazy. I thought I was losing my mind mentally. I mean, just losing it.
Unable to hold their jobs, Kenny launched a new career as a shoplifter. While Kim started turning tricks on the track to support her habit.
How that happens is you get involved with drug use to kill the pain. And you make your money however you can make your money.
Papa Joe Bocchino runs a cafe just off the track on Tennessee Avenue.
What kind of neighborhood is this?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, you're in the heart of crack city.
Papa knows all the local hookers, but he says Kim was different.
You would think she would be the last person that would be on crack. Kim was too clean cut.
Kim's murder hit Kenny hard.
Got a lot of guilt because she's dead. And I should have watched her a little better. I loved her with all my heart.
He allowed us to tape him smoking crack.
I'm dying. I'm dying a slow death right here.
Like Kim, Barbara Breiter also worked the casinos. She was a cocktail waitress.
She was enjoying it, making really good money.
But she got trapped in an abusive relationship with Dominique's father.
How did she end up on the streets of Atlantic City?
She was a victim of domestic violence.
She ended up self-medicating herself.
With drugs?
With drugs.
Barbara spent years in and out of rehab programs for heroin addiction. But the situation didn't improve, especially for Dominique.
None of my parents watched over me because they had something to do. I was left all alone. My dad locked me out of the house. I called the police because he was trying to beat up my mother, and he ripped her hand open right there.
Her father ended up in prison. Dominique was taken away from her mother and briefly put into foster care.
My life was hard with a capital H.
Alone in Atlantic City, Barbara sank into the dark world of the track. Tracy Roberts, herself a young mother, had developed a bad drug habit back in Delaware.
Tracy gave me the impression that she was a street girl.
Friends in Atlantic City say Tracy worked for a time at a local strip joint and was then out on the track with the other working girls.
I knew Tracy the best. We shared rooms together. We went shopping together.
22-year-old Kristen is a 5-year veteran of the Atlantic City streets. Her daily struggle mirrors what Tracy and the other victims were living through shortly before they were killed.
I gotta go out and make some money.
Driven by a $200 a day heroin habit, Kristen is constantly working.
I don't do anything under 100 for sex.
Soliciting Johns on the track or in the casinos.
Walk through the casino, like say you play a slot machine or something, somebody's gonna say something to you.
The streets make anyone tough.
So I've been almost killed 3 times, raped, beaten.
But Kristen's pain is never far from the surface.
Well, you just miss everything. I have a little sister. I miss her growing up, you know. It's hard. I can't get out of this damn place, though.
Kim, Barbara, and Tracy were deep into the street life.
I have to support a drug habit, killer or no killer.
Kristen is still out there. And so is the killer.
Looking for any company tonight?
As investigators learn more about the troubled lives of Kim, Barbara, Tracy, and Molly, a picture of their final days during the fall of 2006 begins to emerge. The timeline is a heartbreaking history. September 9th, while Kim Raffo's boyfriend Kenny is in jail for shoplifting, her ex-husband Hugh Auslander arrives in Atlantic City. Hugh's goal? To find and maybe rescue the mother of his children.
What steps did you take to get her out of this world?
Well, quite simply, I just came up there and I said, look, here's your opportunity. I'm more than happy to help you out of here and get you reestablished to being a normal person.
Kim says yes. Just before she leaves, she records this message for her friend, bartender John Pesch.
Hi, John, it's Kim. I'm getting the hell out of Dodge, and I would really like to say goodbye. Thanks for everything, and I love you.
I just miss her so much. I'd do anything to talk to her just one more time.
Kim spends the next several weeks clean and sober with Hugh in Long Island.
She was doing very well.
In the meantime, women back in Atlantic City start to disappear. On October 7th, 20-year-old Molly Diltz calls her family and then vanishes.
She didn't belong. I think that made her an easier target and more gullible and more trusting of somebody who knew how to lay that trap out.
Molly's Uncle Sam Taylor points out that she had no prostitution arrests, but several people on the street, including Papa Joe, say she'd fallen into the life.
Tell us about Molly Jean Diltz.
Molly, a new kid on the block.
She was here about maybe four or five different times with some of the girls.
October 17th, Barbara Brighter leaves the house in nearby Ventnor where she was living with a friend. When she never returns, her sisters, Fran and Val, eventually try to file a missing persons report. They say they get the runaround, especially after police discover a past prostitution arrest.
Do you think it would have made a difference if they had taken it seriously?
It would have. Had it been put out in the newspaper, it could have scared him away. I believe that there was enough time to maybe save the last two victims.
Sometime in mid-November, a street hustler named Dante says he goes clothes shopping with Tracy Roberts. She buys the outfit she's wearing when her body is found.
She said I'd be back in like an hour. She never came back.
As the days pass, Kristen starts to worry.
It's not like her, so we knew something was wrong.
During this time, Kim Raffo, unaware of what's happening, makes a tragic decision to leave Hugh and return to Atlantic City for good.
Why did she go back? What was it that pulled her?
Well, the streets were calling the name.
Papa Joe may be the last person to see her early in the morning on Sunday, November 19th.
You said you saw her get into a car?
Yes. I literally threw out of here after I fed her and opened the car door, and she said hi to the guy or whatever, and he said hello. And then they left.
Sources tell 48 Hours that Raffo then goes with the John to the Taj Mahal, but leaves him around 5 a.m. to score drugs. The very next day, Kim and the other women are found, barefoot, facing east, in the drainage ditch.
That scenario fits the toxicology reports, which revealed large amounts of cocaine in Kim and Tracy's bodies, alcohol in Molly, and a potentially lethal dose of heroin in Barbara. That raised the theory that the killer sedated his victims with alcohol or drugs.
I'm not prepared really to comment.
Not wanting to tip the killer, Atlantic County Prosecutor Blitz has remained tight-lipped since his first and last press conference. But retired Atlantic City police captain Jim Hutchins thinks the prosecutor should do some explaining.
How long after the bodies were found did they contact you?
I was thinking 3 days.
3 days. Was that quick enough?
No.
Hutchins says his former squad, the Atlantic City Vice Cops, who actually knew the streets and the girls, were not brought into the investigation until precious time had been lost.
I would have gave them whoever they asked for to help, to knock on doors, to interview witnesses, neighbors, the neighborhood where the girls lived, and I wasn't asked to do that.
Hutchins says that may be why, to this day, investigators still don't know if the murders occurred right where the bodies were found or another location, such as a hotel room or a car.
No one knows where the crime scene is.
Correct.
Retired Egg Harbor Township Police Captain John DeAngelis points out another problem. No motive.
Did anyone want these women dead?
Not that we can determine at this point.
On top of all that, an FBI source tells 48 Hours that the scene at the ditch was contaminated by some of the first responders, limiting the amount of forensic evidence that could be retrieved.
Decomposition occurred, which made it very difficult for investigators, you know, to take fingerprints or any other kind of forensic evidence.
The prosecutor denies Hutchins' claims and has recently stated that crucial evidence was recovered from the victims' clothes and bodies. Still, with few signs of progress,
we can infer from maybe the lack of information that's being put out that the investigation is stalled.
Some in law enforcement started paying attention to this man, a profiler named John Kelly.
The profile's goal is to flush the person out, to try and inform the public, to help stimulate the investigation.
Could he bring the portrait of the killer into focus?
He's very comfortable with this area.
Criminal profiler John Kelly thinks he can get inside the mind of the Atlantic City killer.
So John, this is the area where the killer dumped all four bodies. What does this say about the killer?
He's local, he's from the area.
Kelly, a psychotherapist, runs Stalk Incorporated, an organization of former cops and mental health professionals. They created this profile on their own to help the investigation.
Some people look at the work of profilers as some kind of voodoo or something. Does it really work?
Certainly it works. It works in many cases. But it should be used as a tool. It's not the answer-all, end-all.
Certain aspects of the profile are rather exotic. Kelly thinks the killer may be into photography or another visual art.
In watching many of these serial killers, what we've seen is this underlying artistic nature. John Wayne Gacy was into painting. Henry Lee Lucas, another serial killer, was constantly painting.
Other elements are more predictable. For instance, the profile describes the killer as a social misfit.
Very shy, more to himself. He's a loner.
And a patron of prostitutes.
The stroll areas are his hunting grounds, and drug-addicted prostitutes are his prey.
Pursuing the theory that the killer knew the streets, police took an interest in an ex-con named Bill Shlew.
Tell me what kind of parties Shlew would have.
Wild parties, man. Wild parties, man.
Dante, the street hustler, and his buddy Smiley say they hooked Shlew up with drugs and hookers, among others, Kim Raffo and Tracy Roberts.
So he would have these binges with these women for days?
Days,
nights.
Man. We spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, guy.
You're saying parties. Mm-hmm. It was one party that never stopped.
Shlew was questioned by police but never arrested. He has denied any involvement with the murders.
What kind of man committed this crime?
A man on a mission, and his mission is to eliminate prostitutes.
Could the killer be on a religious mission? Kelly thinks the strange fact that all the victims' faces were turned to the east could be a sign of reverence for the Holy Lands of Jerusalem or Mecca.
Whatever the demented message is that he's sending has something to do with the East.
That's how a Muslim named Charles Coles, a convicted drug abuser and a friend of Kim Raffo, says he also wound up being questioned and released. Whatever the killer's religion, Kelly feels strongly he's left a more important clue by leaving all the victims barefoot.
And he's taking their shoes and he's taking their socks. I have to believe we're looking at a serial killer with a foot fetish here.
The foot fetish theory reportedly led police and us to this man, an ex-con named Mark Hesse, who's now an aspiring minister.
My ministry is Global Evangelistic Ministries, given to me by the Holy Spirit.
At the time of the murders, Hesse was living at this flop house on the track, the Fox Manor Hotel. He once offered a woman there a foot massage.
Do you think you became a suspect because they heard about you massaging someone's feet?
Yeah, when I see a woman in sandals and her toes are all painted up and her feet are taken care of, I will compliment her.
During his stay at the Fox Manor, Hesse crossed paths with Barbara Brider and Kim Raffo. He remembers trying, unsuccessfully, to get Kim to give up prostitution.
And that's what bothers me the most, is these people that are not ready to come to the Lord and walk away. A lot of them end up dead.
Did you kill those four women?
No, I didn't. I can't kill anybody. I never have. Never will.
Hesse is apparently not the only man in town with a thing for feet.
Were you looking for any company tonight?
Denise Hill, an experienced prostitute,
what are you doing?
told police she had a close personal encounter with the foot freak at this Best Western the same week the bodies were discovered.
He was talking about my shoes. He liked my shoes, but at this time I didn't know anything about the murders, but he was so obsessed with my shoes.
Denise says she even gave the John a pair of her shoes.
I got him the shoes, so they were just like this color, same color.
But then the date went from strange to terrifying.
He was talking about like really bizarre stuff, like he's killed some people.
If Denise had seen the killer, what did he look like? To find out, we hired criminal image profiler Gene Boylan, who frequently works with the FBI.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, I'm Jeannie.
Boylan is the artist behind several famous sketches, most notably the Unabomber.
Would you see the cheekbones from the side?
Denise told Gene she spent several hours with the man, and though he was wearing glasses and a hat the entire time, she claims his face is seared in her mind.
I see him every night in my head.
Getting that image on paper takes all day. But by nightfall, the sketch reveals what has been locked in Denise's memory for months.
Is this the man that you spent time with in this hotel?
Definitely, yep.
That's him?
Mm-hmm.
We sent the sketch to investigators, but Prosecutor Blitz would not comment on Denise's story. Still, Boylan thinks it can be useful, despite its limitations.
The likelihood is that this is a common outfit for him and that it's something that might trigger a memory with a, you know, a landlady or a neighbor.
In fact, the sketch caught the eye of Barbara Brider's daughter, Dominique. She thinks this man may have come by her parents' house years ago.
When I was in the middle of playing with my mom, she opened the door. He tried to sell her something. I don't know, I've just seen him. And I'm pretty sure it is him.
Still, as the months roll on, none of these leads pan out. Slew, Coles, and Hesse are never charged with the murders, and some of the victims' families grow frustrated.
I don't think they're doing squat. As far as the investigation's going, I don't call it an investigation. I call it a lot of hearsay mumbo-jumbo.
But soon and suddenly, a new suspect is about to emerge.
There are developments tonight in the investigation into the murder of four prostitutes.
After 5 months of dead ends, the harsh spotlight of the investigation turns toward this man, 35-year-old Terry Oleson. On April 3rd, 2007, Police, acting on a tip, search Olison's home in rural southwest New Jersey. They discover a surveillance camera inside this bird feeder. Olison comes in for questioning.
He was the maintenance guy.
As it turns out, in the fall of 2006, Olison was doing odd jobs at the Golden Key Motel, just steps from where the bodies were found. He stayed in this corner room. Fellow guests say he was a loner.
He never said nothing to me. Okay, he was cold. He was cold.
Relatives say Olison was estranged from his family for years and had been having domestic difficulties with a long-term girlfriend. That seems to match the trait of social alienation mentioned on John Kelly's profile.
Mr. Olson comes across as being a very non-social, shy person.
Days after the search, Olison is charged with an unrelated offense.
Mr. Olson is charged with an invasion of privacy.
Videotaping a minor in the nude with a hidden camera. He's being held on $100,000 bail.
He is charged ultimately with being a peeping Tom, yet they're treating him like he's Jack the Ripper.
Olison's attorney, James Leonard.
Terry Olson is not a serial killer. He is not a monster.
He points out that his client, a divorced father, has no felony convictions and is supported by his family.
In our opinion, he is an innocent man who has been caught in this tangled web of an investigation.
But Olison's alleged interest in surveillance video is consistent with another trait on Kelly's profile, visual artistry.
If that's enough to call someone a serial killer, then that list of suspects is certainly going to grow a lot longer.
Leonard says Olison actually helped investigators search for evidence back when the bodies were first found. And so far, there's nothing to suggest he's ever had a foot fetish or any kind of contact with the victims.
I did ask him very candidly if he knew any of these women, and he answered me very adamantly, no.
A clean-cut Olison, out on bond, recalled how he was questioned by police.
We know you did it. That was their exact words. And I'm like, you knew what? How did you get from this to this? That's it. I'm done.
Atlantic County authorities took a hard look at Terry Olison, even getting him to give a DNA sample to compare with evidence from the victims. But so far, they have not charged him with anything related to the four murders.
I wish I had some information for everybody. I have no idea how I got involved in any of this. But I hope they find whoever did this.
The identity of the man in the sketch still remains a mystery.
Dear Kim, I never realized it was possible to miss someone as much as I miss you now.
For now, there will be no Hollywood endings or cliches about closure for the families of the victims. Precious memories and heartfelt tears will have to suffice.
Today was my sister Barbara's funeral. Dominique is holding up well, considering.
Remember this letter that you wrote to your mom?
It says, "Dear Mom, I miss you very much. I will always love you. If you're in heaven, please read this letter. Love your daughter, Dominique."
Like Barbara, Tracy, Molly, and Kim, sadly, all left young children behind. In the meantime, in Atlantic City, tourists swarm the boardwalk. The working girls on the track maintain their wretched routine.
Make some money, and then I go get some drugs. And then when the drugs are gone, I go make more money.
I'm a good person. I'm just stuck in a bad life.
For Kristen, the young drug-addicted streetwalker, the future is painfully clear.
It's hard, because party wants to get better and party is sick, you know? It's hard. I know what's going to happen. I'm not going to lie to myself. I'm not going to lie to people. You know, it's jail or death.
But for all the lost souls trapped on Atlantic City streets, There is one ray of hope.
I'm so glad that Dominique got out.
Val and her husband have adopted Dominique. They are raising her with their two sons in Florida.
I will continue to just love her and support her.
Dominique's home life is stable. She's getting counseling, and she's performing superbly in school.
I plan to go to college, all the way up to college, and stay in college for 10 years.
Dominique's future is very bright. This isn't the end for her at all.
If you have information about this case, please call the Atlantic County Major Crime Unit at 609-909-7666.